Alrighty, everyone, let's get started. My name's Emma. I'm a member of Social Alternative here in the Melbourne branch, and I'll be chairing your session today, which is on the origins and history of Australian anti-Chinese racism. I'll just quickly introduce Liam. Liam is a long-term member of Social Alternative. He's a union activist and a researcher. He's also the maker of a really wonderful new film called Do Nothing and Do It Well, which is about militant Chinese cabinet makers right here in Melbourne and the history of that. That screened yesterday, and if you didn't see it, you really missed out.
I'll address that later.
You'll get a chance to see it sometime. But seeing as you didn't see the film, you're here, which is good. The film is actually based on research that Liam did in 2015 for a Marxist Left Review article on Chinese political and union organising. The current talk that Liam is giving is for a new upcoming Marxist Left Review article, more focusing on where does anti-Chinese racism come from. So keep an eye out for that as well. Without further ado, please make Liam feel welcome.
Well, the day after the Christchurch Islamophobic terror attack, and just moments before his disgusting head was so wonderfully egged, Fraser Anning had been giving a speech to a room full of fascists. And in that speech, he identified what he saw as the three great threats to Australia. First one, of course, was the Muslims, who he blamed for getting themselves murdered. Second, predictably, were African youths and their so-called gangs. And third were this amorphous and vaguely defined group, the Chinese, who he accuses of, quote, buying up all our land. Now, anyone who's been paying attention in recent years wouldn't find this claim surprising, and nor would they be surprised at its being uttered in a fascist meeting by the would-be Führer. It is these days the most pervasive and widely held myth about Chinese people and their alleged sinister motives in Australia. And needless to say, it's utter rubbish, and I'll prove that in a minute, the question about housing, etc. But first, I want to explain a bit about the purpose of this presentation. I'm going to look at why racism takes particular forms in Australia, and why, among the many Australian racisms, anti-Chinese racism has its own specific history and dynamic. And all of this means really locating racism in the history of the Australian state and Australian capitalism. At its most basic level, and across the world, racism is rooted in capitalism. And that's a point some disagree with, especially those who want to argue that racism isn't historically located or situated, but is rather something that's somehow fundamental to human nature. You can look, for example, at the Australian government's website called Racism, It Stops With Me. I mean, even the titles of things suggest that racism is just something kind of, an individual's problem, something in your brain you need to fix. And according to that site, racism stems from three places: hatred, fear, and ignorance. Now, the site shies away from addressing the obvious question of who in Australia might be encouraging that hatred and fear and ignorance. For example, by spreading lies about Aboriginal people, locking up brown people in refugee concentration camps, and indeed pushing daily lies about the sneaky behaviour of Chinese people. And as for racism being based in ignorance, well, you know, if the government who are pushing all this racism are so much smarter than everyone else, why don't they, you know, just stop doing those racist things? The government, needless to say, has a racist political agenda. So you might say, okay, well, that's to be expected. But the same arguments are backed up by a range of scientific views that try to locate racism in our very biology. And not just scientists from a century or two ago, but in the last decade, there has been a resurgence in highly regarded and influential scientific academic journals running articles from prominent scientists who claim that racism is a result of humans having evolved as beings with an innate sense of us versus them. And really, with a straight face, they write these articles that get published that say that this view of biology explains everything from, you know, why certain fans hate Collingwood to why we end up with genocidal concentration camps. You know, as if they're the same thing. It's garbage science, Anyway, I'm going to move on from that. Thankfully, most serious scholars of human history and society, and not just us Marxists, actually do agree that racism is not a timeless feature of our DNA, but that it first appeared just a few centuries ago with the consolidation of capitalism across the globe. What Marxists grasp that I think is important is that racism emerged at that historical juncture for a number of specific and identifiable reasons. Firstly, it justified colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade. Secondly, it legitimized the maintenance of different categories of workers who were pitted against each other in competition for jobs, for housing, even for a seat on a broken public transport system, and also at its most blatant, workers who were paid higher or lower wages solely on the basis of their designated race. It's also, of course, a way of just pitting workers against each other as a barrier towards effective organising. So you can see in all of these ways how racism is rooted in capitalism, and that would almost apply to any country on earth. There are, as I said, specific... It's not moving. Oh, it's such a big opening, and then... It just fizzes out. Okay, try this again. All right, okay. So everything I've just said obviously is true in the Australian context as well, but there are specificities here that help explain why this country has been so consistently shaped by, at times apparently driven by, an almost elemental racism. And I mean, you know, it can sometimes seem it's sort of intrinsic to the air that we breathe here. Australian racism isn't just a few violent insults thrown at someone on a bus, but rather it is a structural oppression that has been and still is manifest in genocide, in apartheid, in concentration camps. Australian racism is the basis of laws and legal concepts that kill people, from terra nullius to border protection. And we should remember that when it comes to Australian racism, Chinese people have, since the earliest days of the European invasion of this continent, repeatedly been in the state's crosshairs. The unfederated colonies passed their first anti-Chinese laws in the 1850s, which is after the first but before the second Opium Wars, and both of those wars saw Britain and its allies destroying whole cities and seizing Chinese territory like Hong Kong. And when the first federal parliament finally sat in 1901, after decades of plotting and scheming, the first laws they passed were a cluster that became known forever as the White Australia Policy. Now, the centrepiece of this was the Immigration Restriction Act. And like so many pieces of racist legislation since, it actually attempts to conceal its racist intent by not mentioning Chinese people by name. Instead, the key tool they had for excluding Chinese migrants was the infamous dictation test, which Australian border officials could administer in any European language they chose and as many times as they chose until you failed, because the whole point was to make you fail. This is how the Prime Minister at the time, Edmund Barton, described the point of the Immigration Restriction Act. He said, "We are guarding the last part of the world in which the higher races can live and increase freely for the higher civilization. The doctrine of the equality of man was never intended to apply to the equality of the Englishman and the Chinaman." So why were Chinese people singled out in this way? In short, it's because for the nascent Australian nation, or Australian state rather, there was more to racism than simply the classic divide and rule. It was more than just pitting workers against each other. And that was certainly part of the reasoning, and if you can see that in ways that politicians and employers of the time and union leaders of the time spoke about, you know, cheap Chinese labour, and that's something I take up in the Marxist Left Review article that Emma referred to. But there's more to it than that. The real driving force behind anti-Chinese racism as a particular phenomenon in Australian history has always been this sort of fear of the Australian ruling class of China's capacity, or their perceived capacity, to threaten British, first British, and then later kind of Australian or sort of white, really, white domination over this continent. For many decades, a century or more, the white colonial population in Australia was concentrated in little pockets along the southeast kind of corner of the continent. And the colonial ruling classes lived in endless terror that one day, you know, one horrible morning, they would wake up to learn that China had seized the north of the continent. me. So notwithstanding China's own status, I've got some here. Thanks for reminding me. So yeah, so they were worried that China would just seize the north of the continent. Notwithstanding China's own status as a place that had been carved up and torn apart and oppressed by British and other European colonial powers, China remained the biggest and most militarily advanced power in Asia. In fact, in a pretty twisted irony, the poverty and degradation that British Britain and France in particular were imposing on the Chinese people in China, that was itself seen as a potential reason why all these Chinese people would want to seize Australia to get away from the misery that Britain was inflicting on them in China. You can read that in a lot of the accounts of Australian colonial ruling class figures saying that, were they living all this squalor? They live in all this poverty. Of course they're going to want to come and take this country. So, yeah, there's that. For example, in 1879, the New South Wales Premier Henry Parkes wrote about anti-Chinese laws that were passed in the New South Wales colony. And he describes China. He says, China is a land containing nearly 400 million of souls, where the conditions of life were so trying that it was hard to find standing room, where any outlet would be eagerly seized upon. It is an easy journey from us over a pleasant sea, he said, and thus if they're not restricted, Chinese people would outnumber us on this soil. When South Australia passed similar anti-Chinese laws a year later in 1880, that state's premier said similar things about their laws. He said, the Northern Territory, which was then under South Australian jurisdiction, was only removed by some 7 days steaming from a place where there were 400 millions of Chinese, which might send out unlimited swarms of people to settle down. And again, William Yates, William Goldwyn, sorry, MLC in Queensland, explaining anti-Chinese laws or reflecting on anti-Chinese laws that were passed in that colony in 1876. Starting to bring it, you're seeing a pattern here, right? He says, we were near neighbours to a teeming mass of Chinese. Nearly 400 million of them were separated from us by a narrow stretch of placid ocean. It was a stern struggle for existence in that closely packed country, and the advantages possessed by a rich and sparsely inhabited colony like Queensland must be only too apparent to them. The peaceful invasion had begun. It was idle to think it would cease. So you get the point. The Australian settler colonial ruling class were terrified that 400 million Chinese were all secretly plotting to invade and take Australia from the white people who, of course, had barely finished their own invasion and genocide of the continent, and so that was partly the reason why they felt so vulnerable. This is also the reason why anti-Chinese racism actually differs a bit from other Australian racisms of the time, such as Irish, anti-Irish and anti-Aboriginal racism, where the Aboriginal people were often depicted as this sort of, you know, uncivilized, dying out, backwards kind of people, and Irish people were, you know, barbarians, the kind of adherence to a horrible barbaric religion. Chinese was a bit different. Chinese propaganda is mostly focused on, at that time, the sheer numbers of them, 400 million. So you get figures like things like this, like these people on a pier, you know, white blokes on a pier, looking at this steamer full of Chinese people. It's called Passengers by a China Tea Steamer. It even gets more explicit. The Australian Illustrated News in 1877, literally just calling the cartoon the Chinese invasion. And I don't know if you can see it from all the way the back, but just swarms and swarms of people. Thousands of people. Now, this all might be starting to sound sadly familiar, especially with things that are called the Chinese invasion, if you've been reading the bestsellers lists recently. And you have to say that when you look at the resurgence of anti-Chinese racism in Australia in 2019, the same tropes are at play. We're still warned of secret invasion plans, we're still urged to question the loyalty of ethnic Chinese people who live here, and we're still told there's, quote, too many Chinese people coming to live here. We're told that Chinese students are driving the crowded trams, making the trams crowded, driving congestion on the trams and public transport in the cities. We're told that cashed up Chinese investors are the people behind the historic generational housing crisis, housing pricing crisis in Australia. And just on that, because I promised to debunk it at the start of the talk, according to the Foreign Investment Review Board, in 2016 to 2017, investment from mainland China into Australian residential property was $15 billion. That's less than 2% of the entire residential estate real estate spending market. But remember the figure, $15 billion. Meanwhile, investment from North America, so that's the US and Canada together, was $14 billion. And I'm yet to see anyone go around saying, oh, those bloody Canadians buying all the houses. So, you know, racism, right? That's the end of the talk. Sit down. Yeah. Fucking racist. According to research from leading business analysts, the actual impact of Chinese foreign investment on property prices in Australia in recent years has been zero. No impact at all on the price of property in Australia. What's more, a recent comprehensive study by the Confronting Racism Project, based at Western Sydney University, found that 59% of East Asian Australians experience racial discrimination when trying to rent or buy a house. Now, that racism, of course, trying to get a place and finding that you're blocked because of, you know, the way you look, that racism exists for other peoples of colour, of course, but whereas for East Asian Australians, it's 59% of them report this kind of racism, for other peoples of colour, they report that racism at only 19%. In other words, the panic and paranoia about Chinese people supposedly buying all the houses is actually making it incredibly difficult for Chinese people in Australia to find a place where they can put a bloody roof over their head. That's the real outcome of all this racism. Oh, have I switched? Switched again. Anti-Chinese racism starts at the top of Australian society. I mean, this could be taken straight out of Clive Hamilton's book. You know, the tentacles of it. Starts at the top of Australian society, but like other ruling class ideas, anti-Chinese racism has always fed into the broader population, and often with deadly consequences. From the 1850s through to the 1920s, Australian history is marked with often deadly explosions of racist anti-Chinese pogroms and riots. Now, most historians blame these dark moments on the supposed uneducated, crude, intrinsically xenophobic character of ordinary people. But you can only really sustain that argument if you ignore the historical record. The fact is that those anti-Chinese riots in Australian history are better understood, can really only be understood, as kind of similar to the anti-Lebanese riots on Cronulla in 2005. We all remember that clearly. It took place during Australia's military involvement in the Middle East, just like the anti-Chinese riots here took place during the Opium Wars. And the Cronulla riots were whipped up by, you know, the highest rating media, radio host in Sydney, and the then Prime Minister, John Howard. Now, unfortunately, many historians lack that sort of grasp on how racism functions, of its material basis in exploitation and capitalism and imperialism, let alone of the complex ways in which ruling class ideas circulate and can take root among the rest of the population. But unless you understand the agendas of the ruling class at any given moment in history, how on earth could you possibly explain racism as anything other than evidence of an inbuilt hostility to all markers of physical or cultural difference? This is a deeply reactionary, pessimistic view of humanity, and it also fails to account for all of the glorious history of anti-racist movements that also mark our history, even in this profoundly racist country. Understanding that racism against Chinese people is rooted in the strategic imperialist agenda of the Australian ruling class also helps us understand anti-Chinese racism in Australia right through from the 1880s to the 2010s and today. It also, though, stands as a bit of an urgent warning for us. There's an urgency to this, and I'll show you why. Now, there's another session at this conference focusing on the hidden history of Australian concentration camps, so I'm just going to raise it here and ask that you think about how this relates to this Chinese-Australian population today in an era of growing imperialist tension between the US and China. So, during the First World War, around 6,000 enemy aliens, so-called enemy aliens, were interned in concentration camps in Australia, just like this one, Holsworthy, solely on the basis of being German, Austrian, or Turkish heritage. This included many Australian-born second-generation migrants, And at the end of the war, the overwhelming majority of them were deported, whether they had been born here or not. In perpetrating this disgraceful act of systematized racism, the Australian state all but destroyed a well-established and vibrant German-Australian community, with roots going back 70 years or more. Now, it's true that these migrants were part of a colonial project, and you know we acknowledge and respect the sovereignty that was never ceded on this land. Today, I'm just looking at the racism that the German Australians were subjected to in this period. I think that's just an important qualifier to make, because it has echoes in what we see with Chinese today. Now, the German Australians at the time, since the 1830s, generations of migrants from the Prussian Empire and then Germany had arrived on this continent and built lives here. Whole towns and whole suburbs had German names. There were German festivals, German marching bands, German eateries, German artistic and political clubs. Historian Gerhard Fischer paints a picture of life in Adelaide at the time and says you could have spent a whole day in Adelaide just speaking German. People of German heritage at the time made up about 4% of the total Australian population. And Fischer notes that you could quite easily, spend a whole day speaking German. So, what happened to that German population? Well, as we know, there was a war, but in the years preceding the outbreak of World War I, a barrage of relentless anti-German sentiment began building. You know, newspapers running headlines about spies, you know, every German person in Australia was a spy, you had to question their loyalty, they had to renounce their, you know, had to swear an oath of fealty to the bloody Queen of England. The Australian establishment quite deliberately created a situation of extreme pressure, trying to, you know, to whip up this racism. And propaganda like this poster, I don't know if you can see it all at the back, but it says, Australians arrive, save her from this shame, and Australia's been crossed out to say New Germany, and all of the names of the capitals have been turned into sort of German-sounding names, like Melbourne is called Zeppelinburg. I want to live in Zeppelinburg. Led Zeppelinburg. So, where was I? Where was I before I went on? Needless to say, so a barrage of racism like this about German spies everywhere and secret German plots to take over Australia, and needless to say, once the war broke out, the racist measures were introduced with gusto. Dozens of towns renamed themselves. Whole generations of people changed their names. Schmitz became Smiths, etc. Where once dozens of Australian towns, almost every town would have had a Bismarck Street or a Wilhelm Street. Like, seriously, today you would struggle to find half a dozen in the whole country. The long-established German-Australian community was being torn apart because of the tensions between the British and the German empires in Europe. And as those tensions reached fever pitch, both those empires were driven to keep expanding their reach and influence, to muscle each other out where they could, and to try to ensure their ability to keep generating wealth and power and influence. Both these two empires were butting up against each other. It started with trade wars, allegations of spying, espionage. We know where this leads, right? And we know what it sounds like. It sounds like today. It sounds like the Murdoch press this morning. You know, we've seen this before. And not just the Murdoch press, of course. Four Corners last week. So you could be forgiven for thinking that, you know, well, that was the First World War. That was a century ago. Things have changed. Surely this wouldn't happen again. But it did happen again. In World War II, in the lead-up to World War II, the same racism came out. Everyone was a spy again. Everyone had their loyalty questioned again. And another generation of Germans, but also Italians and Japanese, were locked up in Australian concentration camps. During World War II, 16,700 people were locked up as enemy aliens. Again, we're talking about... I'm just going to jump through that. So I want you to keep all this in mind. These people Australian citizens and Australian residents, often tracing their heritage back generations. In the case of German Australians in World War I, they make up about 4% of the population. This is remarkably similar, actually, in demographic terms to what we'd say about Chinese Australians today. And think of all them as we go through the rest of the talk. Jump forward a bit to October 2017, and the head of ASIO, the head goon, secret goon, spy of ASIO, Duncan Lewis, is announcing, you know, doing a media launch for their latest important review into espionage. And Duncan Lewis says that espionage and foreign interference is an insidious threat. Activities that may appear relatively harmless today can have significant future consequences. ASIO, he says, has identified foreign powers clandestinely seeking to shape the opinion of members of the Australian public, the media organisations, and government officials in order to advance their country's own political objectives. And not only that, but that these activities, undertaken covertly to obscure the role of foreign governments, represent a threat to our sovereignty and the integrity of our national institutions and the exercise of our citizens' rights. Now, there's no surprise, he doesn't mention China, but there's no surprise here that he's talking about the People's Republic of China. But more than that, right, beneath all this kind of dramatic language, he's actually referring specifically to the 180,000 approximately Chinese international students who are studying in Australia and who were enrolled here in 2017-2018. In other words, the head of Australia's peak domestic spying agency would have you believe that the Chinese students, who honestly, I'm a lecturer, like half the time you struggle to get them to turn up to class. You know, like if they're spies, they're not doing a great job. He would have you believe that this is the biggest threat to Australia since the end of the Cold War. Now, ASIO aren't alone on this. In recent years, a concerted campaign of anti-Chinese panic has really just come thick and fast from both parties, from all major parties, from the government, from the media, from the universities themselves. And, of course, there are endless scandals about Chinese companies like Huawei, Chinese millionaires like Huang Jingmo, and apparently, it's a never-ending string of foreign officials buying business, buying favour from politicians, etc. In 2018, partly as a consequence of all this kind of anti-Chinese panic, the Australian Parliament passed a set of Cold War-style laws that really everyone knows are aimed at China. This is the Foreign Interference Bill. Now, in the lead-up to this 2017 report, which was the pretext for the bills, liberal media outlets like Fairfax Media and the ABC started running these ridiculous headlines. So they're all up to their neck in it as well. They run headlines like this. They put out statements like espionage and foreign interference in Australia are occurring on an unprecedented scale, etc. And of course, it wasn't just the media. In response to the ASIO report, the then Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, whose government was at that very moment engaged in fundamental and unprecedented attacks on academic freedom, put out a public call to Chinese students, ordering them to respect academic freedom with a straight face. You know, I mean, we giggle, but it's just, the madness of it. The Chinese students themselves had more pressing concerns, though, than what Julia Bishop might have said to them. When the Chinese embassy issued a warning to Chinese international students last December, just December last year, it caused immediate outrage in the media. For most commentators, or Australian commentators, the announcement itself from the Chinese embassy was just evidence of duplicitous behaviour from Beijing. This was all part of, the sneaky game of one-upmanship that China is playing to pit the students here against Australian interests or whatever they think it is. Part of that was a bunch of these journalists, Australian journalists, said that this threat to Chinese students about, watch out for violent racists in Australia, that this was part of a sneaky move in which Beijing was threatening that Australia passed those foreign interference bills, that China would then pull out all of those 180,000 students and destroy the Australian education market. Needless to say, they missed an important part of the puzzle here, which is that actually Chinese students were at the time having the shit beaten out of them by violent racists. Like, the embassy did not make this up. Last year, there was a wave of violent attacks on Chinese students in Canberra. A number of those students reported that their assailants said to them while they were kicking their heads in, "Go back to China." And, of course, the scandal really was that the police were saying, "You'll never guess, we don't think it's racially motivated." So, So most commentators actually ignore that. Now, in terms of this thing about pulling out, China supposedly pulling out all their students, even Universities Australia, which is the peak kind of industry group for vice-chancellors, and certainly not my friend, I'm standing here in a union T-shirt from my boss's organisation, even they said, "We don't think that's possible or actually doable, that China could just pull out 180,000 students. But this is where the story gets weird, because for most commentators, the very fact that Universities Australia would make a claim like that and say it's impossible that China could pull out all their students, that is proof that Universities Australia are in on it. Right? They're in on it. Either they're in on it or they're naive. And that actually, Universities Australia, I never thought I'd be saying you're saying this, but go with me, right? Universities Australia is part of a secret plot to entrench Chinese influence in Australia to further its imperialist reach in order to turn Australia into a tribute state of Beijing. I'm not even joking. I don't agree with that. I'm not even paraphrasing. I'm literally quoting from this guy. Now, this book is one of the best-selling books in Australia at the moment. Clive Hamilton. And he actually says this stuff. Now, we're going to have to look at this book at length, I'm afraid. It's one of the most racist... I spent the summer reading it. It's one of the most racist things I've ever read. We have to talk about this book. But before I go down this particular Hamilton rabbit hole, I just want to state a few things plainly. Clive Hamilton has a barely concealed contempt for Chinese students. He dedicates whole chapters to painting them as all spies and brainwashed dupes. He recycles all of the unsubstantiated allegations that they're all spying on their lecturers and reporting each other to the embassy, etc., etc. Hamilton also... I mean, that's not enough, right? The icing on the cake here. Hamilton also expresses deep suspicion towards the thousands of Chinese people who gained asylum and citizenship here after the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. He claims they were, quote, mostly economic migrants who weren't facing persecution. Now this, for a man whose whole fucking book is premised on the repressive nature of the Chinese state, I mean, it takes a special kind of racist asshole to make that claim. Now, he takes it further, though. He says that among the Chinese granted asylum here in that period were those who he claims would become, this is his words, would go on to become some of the most effective agents of influence in Beijing's campaign to transform Australia into a tribute state. This is the Tiananmen Square refugees. Right? He also claims that many of them backed the crackdown, and he then, in a totally unsourced and revolting accusation, he quotes one of his anonymous friends. It's always handy to have anonymous friends, isn't it? One of his anonymous friends who claims that each year on the 4th of June, groups of Chinese Australians get together to drink a toast to the Tiananmen Square massacre for getting them permanent residency in Australia so they can continue their job of turning Australia into a tribute state of Beijing. So that's the first thing I want to say about Clive Hamilton. He is an arsehole and a racist and the rest of it. But the second thing about Hamilton, and this is where it actually gets a bit more serious for us, is that anti-Chinese racism is not a myth. And pointing out that racism, is not an act of weaponizing the narrative. Now that phrase is what Hamilton's supporters use when you point out that you're sounding a bit racist. They're saying, oh, you're weaponizing the narrative. They've actually said this in a bunch of Daily Telegraph pieces recently. So just remind ourselves, here are the facts on anti-Chinese racism in Australia, according to the most comprehensive research project on the topic, which was published just last November. People of East Asian heritage in this country, which mostly means Chinese, report experiencing racism at a high and increasing rate. In fact, almost double the rate of other ethnic minorities, with 85 to 86% of East Asian Australians reporting experiences of daily racism. But for Hamilton and his backers, anti-Chinese racism in Australia is found only in the distant past or on the political fringes of the far right. They say that allegations of anti-Chinese racism in Australia today are just a myth born of liberal white guilt, or worse, that it's a deliberate lie designed to distract from the secret Chinese invasion. Today's peddlers of anti-Chinese racism would have you believe that the large and diverse Chinese Australian population, from students to construction workers, from cleaners to kitchen hands to tech entrepreneurs, from fourth or fifth generation Australians to people who've literally just arrived, that all of them are potentially part of some fifth column whose loyalty can't be trusted, and that they're complicit in this war that has already begun. If you take nothing else from this talk, I mean, bear in mind, they're not talking about concentration camps, but that's the direction it heads in, right? You can see why I started with the German stuff earlier. If you take nothing else from this talk, and I'm not done yet, it's this. This book there are large and influential sections of the small L liberal left who are seriously and wholeheartedly backing this. And that's why you can't just dismiss it easily as the kind of racist rantings of a Pauline Hanson or a Fraser Anning. Hamilton's book has brought to the surface, it fits into that long tradition of Australian racism. The panic is the same, the fear is the same, the secret invasion, all of that harks back to earlier manifestations of anti-Chinese racism. It's also brought to the surface a deep divide among academia, and it's split the Greens in two. So, like, obviously nobody's denying that the Chinese state is undertaking all sorts of, you know, influence peddling. Every state does that in a competitive global order, even the small ones. And I tell you what, if someone spent the amount of research that Hamilton has done onto the CCP and its alleged influence peddling, if someone took that amount of effort and applied it to something like AusAid, like, there would be outrage at the grubby imperialist plots that are at the heart of that particular government program. But nonetheless, Hamilton's book has come under some attack, at least, from some of the better left-wing academics, most notably Dave Brophy, who some of us know. He's a left-wing expert on China based at University of Sydney. But the fact is, many other important and left-leaning academics have lined up behind Hamilton, either openly endorsing his book or at least defending the general line. This includes Mayfin Guo, Paul McGregor, and John Fitzgerald. John Fitzgerald has been particularly effusive. That's his little quote across the top of the book, explaining how important it is. But all three of them, I mean, the names might not mean much to you, but if you read that MLR article that we've mentioned, wow, really? 35 minutes? If you read that MLR article that we mentioned earlier from 2015 about, needless to say, all three of them have contributed massively to reassessing the kind of whitewashed racist narrative of the Chinese population, the history of the Chinese population in Australia, and yet all three of them have endorsed what is essentially a 300-page anti-Chinese tirade. So I guess the question is why, and I would say that what we're seeing here is a failure of politics. It's a deep failure of small-L liberalism. It's relatively easy to be, you know, progressive or anti-racist about things that happened in the past, or that things that don't have a direct bearing on your own ruling class's immediate imperialist agenda. But when your ruling class and its allies are digging in for a serious confrontation with another world power, in other words, when the USA and Australia are moving towards, you know, increasing conflict and possibly eventually war with China, well, then developments will pose big challenges to people who harbour illusions in their country's own state or in the essential goodness of their own rulers. And so, sure, you might find some of the racism here a little bit grubby, but, you know, if Australia is better than China, or if Australia is essentially good, then, you know, this is the price you pay. I think what we're seeing there is that unfolding. It's for these same reasons that the Australian Greens have found themselves at loggerheads over Hamilton's book. Hamilton himself, some of you might remember, was the Greens candidate for Kooyong after Peter Costello resigned. And today, he's still a member of the Greens. Today, the right wing of the Greens have taken up the anti-Chinese line with gusto. Not only did they push for the party to promote the book and actually run the official launch of the book, but they have tried to position the party at the very front of a sort of anti-Chinese crusade. And let's finish then by looking at what that means on the ground, or what it looks like. In October 2018, the Tasmanian Greens leader, Cassie O'Connor, launched a vile attack on newspaper editor and Hobart City Council candidate, Yongbei Tang. Now, as a pretty ordinary and essentially apolitical candidate, the sort we've seen a million of over the years, Tang cast her election campaign as an attempt to redress what she saw as the ethnic imbalance in Australian politics, which she said was dominated by white people, which is obviously true. Truth. So, logically, but as it would turn out scandalously, Tong encouraged Hobart residents in China, the Chinese residents in Hobart, to vote for her in the Hobart City Council elections. Now, her slogan wasn't, you know, yellow peril supports black power, or, you know, fuck whitey, or it certainly wasn't long live the CCP. It was, if you can see it here, if you can make out the controversial slogan here, I'll read it to you, together for a better Hobart. Now, seriously, though, this kind of politics of, like, you know, I'm an aspiring newspaper editor and I'm going to be someone, and what have I got to offer? I have no politics, so I'll just call on my people to get the vote out, you know. Like, this is the norm in student union elections, in every local council I've ever lived in, and federal elections for that matter. Ask anyone of Chinese heritage, there are a few in the room, about the emails, the various letters they receive from, you know, good folk in the ALP who have a Chinese friend. My Chinese friend, I like. This is the norm in all of these politics. But according to the Greens, Tang's campaign was far from harmless. Speaking in state parliament with the benefit of parliamentary privilege, O'Connor accused Tang's council campaign of being secretly backed by the CCP itself, and predictably the Murdoch press, the Hobart Mercury, joined in the assault. The attacks on Yongbei Tang were racist, and they came from all angles. While the Greens and the Murdoch press were labelling her a spy, Hobart's Nazis, and I apologise for this, were defacing her billboards with racist slogans. And it gets worse. When a local journalist asked the Tasmanian Greens leader, Cassie O'Connor, if perhaps, given the fact that Nazis are now defacing Tong's billboards, maybe you'd want to woe back a bit on the anti-Chinese rhetoric, Cassie O'Connor dug in. She said, well, you know, the Nazis are also defacing the billboards of the ALP candidate who's Indian. So you can hardly blame my anti-Chinese rhetoric on the, you know, nothing to do with me. And so, yeah, she dug in. And eventually, with the Greens, the Murdoch press, and the Nazis all lining up to attack her, Yongbei Tang stopped giving interviews and released a quite sad little press statement. It's kind of heartbreaking. I don't have time to read the whole thing, but at the end of it she says, I mean, she's lived in Hobart for 15 years, and previously she had been interviewed on how great it was to be, you know, starting a new family and a new life in this town, you know. Anyway, a few years later, she thinks, I'm going to run for council because that's what good migrants do, you know. And then this happens to her. And then she says, my campaign poster located in Newtown was vandalised with a racist slur. I feel disgusted, sad and ashamed. Now, I mentioned that anti-Chinese racism is splitting the Greens. And the clearest example of that is the way that the Australian Young Greens responded to these developments in Tasmania, and to O'Connor in particular. The Young Greens released an open letter denouncing O'Connor and reaffirming their own commitment to anti-racism, and they demanded that O'Connor resign from the party. It's actually a very good statement, but of course it's fallen on deaf ears. O'Connor remains at the head of the Tasmanian party, and as we speak, there's a notable silence from most of the prominent left-wing Greens like Adam Bandt, for example, who never mentions anti-Chinese racism, never feels this is something he needs to take up. Now, if you're surprised by these developments in Hobart, with Greens echoing Nazis and a racist witch hunt, you might want to think that over a bit more. Think about the whole history of Australian racism that we went through at the start of this session. And on that note, I'll finish with three other disgusting scenes. Two of these are from the last 12 months, and one of them is from a century ago. And these are scenes that I think drive home the long history of anti-Chinese racism in Australia. The relentless nature of anti-Chinese racism on the far right, and the complicity of small L liberals, both then and now. As the imperious rivalries heat up between the US and China, we can expect more anti-Chinese racism in Australia. And honestly, we will be searching in vain if we think that progressive parties like the Greens are automatically going to be on the right side. So here are my three final images. On one side, you have these Nazi posters that were put up at Monash University and Melbourne University a couple of years ago. In the middle, you have Hillary Clinton, a leading figure of Western imperialism and of Western liberalism, sorry, and of course a would-be ruler of the US, the US Empire. And just on that one quickly, when the ABC, so she toured Australia last year, and when the ABC's Lee Sales asked for her opinion about Chinese influence peddling on Australian campuses, Clinton responded in language that should send chills down the spine of any anti-racist. You should recognise the language, and you know it has a history because it's basically the same words that are written on the side of his crate from the 19th century cartoon where you see a young white boy being threatened by a Chinese man, and on the side of the crate here it says, Australia for Australians. So what did Clinton say to Sales when she asked her? She said, I think Australians need to be for Australians. Americans need to be for Americans, and whether it's Russia in a secret way interfering with our election or China looking to influence our policy, we should just say no. So let me restate everything by way of a conclusion. Anti-Chinese racism has been a constant in Australia, The European invaders here were driven by strategic agendas to build a white population who would be loyal, in their eyes, to Britain as an outpost of whiteness in the Asian region. They saw China as their main regional rival, and they were terrified that China would seize this continent or even overrun it with Chinese immigrants. Hence, Chinese people had to be blocked, they had to be excluded, they had to be vilified, demonised, and so on. This is why the White Australia policy endured until well into the 1970s, notwithstanding the slow wind back of some aspects of it over the preceding 40 years. It's also why today the merest whiff of allegations of Chinese espionage bring a response out of all, hysterical response out of all proportion to the incident itself. I should also acknowledge, as I did earlier, that anti-Chinese racism in Australia historically it was also manifest in the inaccurate descriptions of Chinese workers as cheap labour, as pliant, docile, impossible to unionise. That's a very important kind of stream of Australian anti-Chinese racism that I go through in that MLR article and the film that we mentioned. But today, I really wanted to take up that argument about the imperial agendas, the imperial rivalry, the whole project of creating a white kind of state here, and how that became the central driving force around anti-Chinese racism. It's clear that there are links between anti-Chinese racism today and anti-Chinese racism in the 19th century, but there are also links with anti-German racism. Now, it's true that history never repeats, in exact ways at least, but sometimes the echoes are stark. All right. Sometimes it repeats so closely that it seems it's doing the same thing. So I'm not standing here today saying that the Australian ruling class is about to throw, all the Chinese people in concentration camps. There are differences today as much as there are similarities. Most importantly, the powerful legacy of anti-racist struggles in the last half century would put some limits on a straight-up replaying of that kind of situation. But on the other hand, the racist concentration camps already exist. They're already there. I mean, the news that white Australia ended almost 5 decades ago and that Australia is, hashtag not racist anymore must come as nothing but a cruel and sick joke to the thousands of, people of colour who are still detained indefinitely in Australian concentration camps. But more importantly even than that, really, we know that we are living in an era of where capitalism is more brutal, more crisis-prone, and prepared to jettison even any semblance or pretense that it may once have had that it would stand up for human rights. And when you put all that together, I think it becomes very obvious of the sort of horrific situation that we're in. We should note, and we all have, the role that the Australian establishment played in fostering, in whipping up Islamophobia, and we know where that took us. We know that led us to Christchurch, and we know what it means. It means the same thing as all, it's just as much about Christchurch as it is about all of those German, those towns in Australia that have, lost their German names, not to mention their German population. But we can't afford to be complacent about any of this. When Australian politicians, journalists and ASIO agents throw around accusations about Chinese spies and Chinese, secret operatives and fifth columns, it should be sounding warning bells for all of us. Our task really is not to say, that's all a bit extreme. That guy just stood there and said there's going to be a concentration camp soon. It didn't. But our task is not to say that the worst is impossible. Our task is to understand that the worst has happened here. We did have racist concentration camps. The situation that's unplaying now bears remarkable similarities to things that have happened in the past. And of course, this is already a very racist country. Our job really is to acknowledge that it has happened before and we're not going to let it happen again. And that the Chinese people who live in this country and elsewhere won't be left to weather the coming racist storm on their own.